Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The death of George Floyd while in police custody last week in Minneapolis may have been a breaking point. Police were called when Floyd allegedly tried to pass a counterfeit bill and appeared to be intoxicated. After being handcuffed, a white police officer held his knee to Floyd's neck while Floyd said he couldn't breathe repeatedly. That now former police officer was charged with murder late last week. Floyd's death set off a wave of protest and outrage across the country that sometimes turned violent, including the protest over the weekend in Harrisburg. It comes after a black jogger in Georgia was shot and killed in a struggle with a white man who armed himself thinking the jogger could be a burglar. A white woman called the police in New York's Central Park after an African-American man told her to follow the rules of the park. These recent incidents have raised questions about racism and why black men especially are often the victims of violence, sometimes at the hands of the police and in American society as a whole. We have multiple guests on today's program, a lot of moving parts. Joining us in the first segment of today's program is Sandra Thompson, a York area attorney and president of the York County chapter of the NAACP. Ms. Thompson was one of five African-American women playing golf at a York County course last year when the owner called the police after a dispute over slow play arose. Ms. Thompson, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Dean Esserman. He's with the National Police Foundation, their senior counselor, former police chief at Providence, Rhode Island, and two other cities, as well as a former assistant district attorney in New York City. Chief Esserman, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Sandra Thompson, let me begin with you, and we'll go back to last Monday, a week ago today. When you saw that video of the police officer with his knee on the neck of George Floyd, what were your thoughts?
We're watching a murder. And actually, how it was callous as well to see the officer defiant to the standers-bys who's also pleading for him to get off of the gentleman, Mr. Floyd, to have him callous to Mr. Floyd's calls of being unable to breathe, being in pain, even calling out to his mother. The officer, you could just see him staring into the crowd, into the camera with defiance, with his hand in his pocket and his knee continuing to be on Mr. Floyd's neck while he stood or laid helpless and motionless. So he's definitely not resisting. So I felt hopeless, just as hopeless as he was.
Why does this keep happening? And when I say keep happening, that there have been a number of incidents over the last 5 to 10 years in American cities of incidents where police officers have hurt or killed, or a black man has been killed while in custody.
Well, the list of say their name is continuing to grow, sadly. There's too many. Unfortunately, why it keeps happening is no one's taking accountability, and there are too many excuses made for it. So whenever something occurs, people are always looking for what is the other reason. The person must have done something. And the reality is it was just wrong. It was just a violation, and it was just because of the person's race. And if the more the community deals with that underlying issue, that people are being attacked, people are being arrested, people are being brutalized just because of their race, when they deal with that, then they can deal with the underlying issues of why that occurs. But unfortunately, the community still wants to have some other reason and some other justification. Oh, he wrote a bad check, or he submitted some type of forged document. So that meant an officer should knee on his neck to where he cannot breathe, to where it has taken away his life. So,
When you say, no, I just wanted to follow up with what you were saying, that just because of his race. Obviously, the police officers involved in these situations have not come out and said, you know what, that was because that was a black man. So my question is, you know, there will be some people say, well, is that the case when you say it's just because of his race? Or is it just the sheer numbers that say that it's just because that these are black men that it's happening more often to?
Well, when you look at, keep all the factors the same except race. A store calls the police on a white man to say that they believe he forced a check. I do not believe that the officers would have engaged that man like they engaged Mr. Floyd. There was no accounts that I saw that he was being violent to the officers, and the officers were overly aggressive to him. It's the value that you put on a life. And unfortunately, that's why there's a constant cry that black lives matter, because unfortunately, black lives have been deemed by officials to matter less. In social media, you see murderers and actually where they have been arrested, and they have been given water because they were thirsty, dehydrated. They have been taken to a fast food restaurant because they were hungry. You see the contrast in white suspects who actually were accused of committing murders, who they have no bruises on their face compared to black male suspects for very much lesser crimes, not murder, being bruised and battered. And again, for much less crimes, winding up dead, being killed. So, yeah, that's why we say it's because of race.
Chief Esterman, I'll ask you the same question that I asked Ms. Thompson. What did you think when you saw that video?
I greatly agree with what I just heard. I found it horrific and disgusting. And I think most of my colleagues across the country who I've talked to over the past week feel the same way, as do most police officers. It's inexcusable. And it's an embarrassment to the uniform. It's humiliating to see an officer commit that kind of crime in front of everyone, let alone commit it at all.
Well, let's get into training and what was done wrong. As a police officer, someone who was a police chief, when you looked at that, okay, your emotions were that you thought it was disgusting, you thought it was wrong, you probably thought this is really going to bring a lot of bad attention to police officers across the country. But what specifically, other than obviously it ended in a tragedy, but what specifically did that police officer do that was wrong?
Well, first off, my first impression is that there was no respect for the sanctity of life. The most important tool that a police officer learns across the country in training is his mouth and communication. Most often, things don't need to get physical. And when they do, an officer has a responsibility to control the situation as quickly as possible with as least force as possible. It seems this was the exact opposite. Got physical quickly, it was maximum force, it was never decreased. And it was using a dangerous, forbidden technique that has been banished from policing for some years and is not taught in academies anymore.
Well, that brings up a point. You have a suspect who is handcuffed and is face down on the ground. What does the training say? How are you to, maintain to keep that suspect in line? I mean, the neck, I mean, as you have said, the knee on the neck is something has been forbidden. It's been banned by most police departments. But what was he supposed to do when there was a suspect who has been cuffed already?
Well, it's been my experience over 25 years as an American police chief that most suspects voluntarily comply, that they even voluntarily comply to be handcuffed because they know it's a procedure that's required. If there's a force in use, you use the minimal force amount needed. Sometimes it's necessary to take someone down to the ground and quickly handcuff them and then quickly get them up off their stomach, bring them to their side or let them sit up or stand up. It's a device used without a knee on the neck or the head. just to control somebody by putting them on their stomach. But the idea of putting your knee on their neck or their head is horrible. It's something that we're trained to avoid doing because we know it's dangerous. And there's no explanation. There's no reason that can be trained into in ever training an officer to do such a thing.
Will that video be used in training in the future?
I hope so. I would use it.
Saying this is what not to do.
I don't just bring criticism to the officer who did it. I bring criticism to those who watched and didn't stop it. All involved are guilty. It's not enough to just say I was there and I didn't do anything. An officer has a responsibility to control his fellow officer if he's out of control.
Yeah, there's
everyone has responsibility for the sanctity of life, not just the officer who is hands-on.
Actually, I saw a video over the weekend, and I forget what city it was in, but there was another officer, had a protester, had his knee on the neck, and a fellow officer pushed it away, pushed it off of the person on the ground, pushed it off their neck. You know, Sandra Thompson mentioned about the officer having his hands in his pocket, and I wondered about that too. I mean, that just seems really strange that you have a knee on the police officer has his knee on the suspect's on the guy's neck, but has his hands in his pocket. I don't know. Can that even be explained?
Not by me. Not by anybody who's been in the business.
So it's just that, you know, it almost seems like the guy was being lazy. Is that, okay, this is the way that I'm going to control this man by putting my knee on his neck, but I'm just going to put my hands in his pocket and not do anything else. This particular officer had 12 complaints against him in a 19-year career. That sounds like a lot. Is it?
Not necessarily a lot. Because the question is whether they were founded or not, whether they not the accusation, but whether they were found guilty in these accusations. If they're found guilty in these accusations, then they are a lot. If they were simply allegations that turned out to be unfounded, then not necessarily. But we have early warning systems that we've developed over the last 20 years and 30 years, which alerts police departments when there are complaints to start doing their due diligence to investigate the officer and to prevent future abuses by doing training and intervention and punishment and discipline if necessary. So at least the number of allegations should have created an early warning system to alert the department about the officer's behavior.
When you say they're unfounded, I guess I was looking for sheer number. In a city the size of Minneapolis, with many more people, again, I don't know whether a dozen complaints are a lot, but as you said, they have been investigated, but it should have raised red flags. I mean, it's probably hard to put a typical number on a police officer in a city the size of Minneapolis, but is there one? Is there an average of what? How many complaints against an officer?
No, there really isn't. It really depends on whether the complaints are similar in nature or not, and whether they're clustered or not in time. Those are the key indicators. Similar behavior, whether founded or unfounded, and whether they happen in a period of time close to one another. Then that's an indication that there's a behavior that's clearly demonstrated, even if not proved, and needs to be paid attention to by the police department.
Mm-hmm. So, Sandra Thompson, let me come back to you for just a moment. So, you know, we're going to get into the protest across the country and the anger that much of the country has shown over the past week or so. But just looking at that video and the aftermath, what do you want from police officers, police departments going forward?
The example that you gave from social media that another officer went and pushed the knee off of from that officer from a suspect. I saw another video where a police officer went into the crowd, and it was a white male police officer went into the crowd and sort of aggravating the crowd as well. Then on the crowd had their hands up. There was one woman kneeling on the ground with her hands up. He went by her and pushed her without cause. A black woman, a police officer, came up to him and started reaming him out. And so the crowd appreciated that. The community is appreciating all these police officers, the police chiefs that are speaking out against Minneapolis Police Department. And what was done in Mr. Floyd's death, there's police officers who are being praised for taking a knee with these protesters. So the community needs to see more of the police engaging in humanity and respect and empathy for what the community is suffering and what the community is encountering, and to treat the community humanely. So that's what will make the difference.
But
may I add to that?
Sure, go right ahead.
I think silence is not an option here for police leaders and sheriffs. Police need to be loud and clear that police are against police abuse as well. The only thing I would differ is that it's outrage of the actions of the officer, not the actions of the department itself. The many good officers in the Minneapolis Police Department who are being tainted by the actions of this one officer. But it's time not to be silent anymore. It's time to be as loud spoken as any citizen in this country and say that police are against police abuse as well.
But, you know, something, though, and Ms. Thompson, I want to bring this up to you, and Chief Esperman, you can weigh in as well, that all those examples that you gave from protest over the weekends, that was after the fact. I mean, overall, you're saying there's a systemic problem with police departments and racism. What has to happen so that that is something of the past? In your mind, what has to happen?
Just accountability. There has been historically the discussion about the blue wall, about remaining silent. So police officers who would want to make a report and are retaliated against are fired, so they don't. That police officers who would want to make a report or would want to make a change fear that they're not going to be covered when they're out on the street. You have, so yes, the police officers have to feel safe themselves to be able to police the police, that they're not going to be retaliated against and they're going to be praised, be honored, be treated fairly. And then the more the community sees the police policing the police, they will build up trust for the police, because there's such a lack of distrust when you see three or other officers in sight of the officer over top of Mr. Floyd, but not doing anything about it. With all the cries of the community, with all the cries of Mr. Floyd, they do not intervene. And you see that a lot. A lot of times the officers are actually keeping the crowd back. The one police officer, I don't recall his name, but I understand he may have been a brother-in-law to the other police officer actually kneeing Mr. Floyd. He was actually blocking the camera. So he was positioning his body to block the camera, and that's often what you see police or other police officers doing. When people pull out cameras, they threaten the people or they block the camera so you can't really get a full view of what's being done to the suspect. So that is what breeds a lack of trust in the community. And when the police stop doing that and start holding their own officers accountable and speaking up and speaking out, then that would build up a trust for the community, with the community. And also when people are held accountable to stop weaponizing police against people of color.
And we're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. Chief Esserman, let me follow up with you. Is there a systemic problem of racism or black suspects being treated differently in this country?
Well, I think you have to just look at what's happened over the years and say yes, that the visuals are showing things that have been happening for a long time but haven't been seen because we haven't had TV cameras or phone cameras or such transparency. When almost every incident we can look at in the country is a black man being the victim, and we have to acknowledge that something is wrong. And how are we going to address it? But first we have to acknowledge that something is wrong, that there are assumptions being made about men of color that drive bias. We can work on that once we acknowledge it, whether it's training, whether it's selection process, whether it's emphasis on values of sanctity of life. I think the real most profound answer is community policing. because it's hard to hate up close. It's hard to distrust up close. When you know your officer and your officer knows you, it brings down a lot of tension. It brings the bias down against the uniform. It brings bias down against the skin color. Community policing is what's evolved in this country, and it's being implemented around the country, and it really needs to be implemented nationwide. It would be a very different story if everyone knew each other in that situation, I would hope. It would bring down some of the tension. It's hard to do policing anonymously. It's hard to do policing stranger to stranger. We're beyond the blue uniform today. It's the person in the uniform that matters, not just the uniform.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional.
Welcome back to
Smart Talk. The news cycle continues to expose how America contends with racism. WNYC and Minnesota Public Radio present America, Are We Ready? A national call-in about racism, violence, and our future together. It's a two-hour national discussion tonight from 8 to 10 on WITF 89.5 and 93.3. We're talking about the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd in Minnesota. Should say the alleged murder. The officer has been charged but hasn't been tried yet. The protests that have occurred since then. And it's brought up a number of issues having to do with race and how African Americans, people of color, are treated by police officers and society as a whole. We're joined now by Reverend Dr. Frank Hairston Allen. He's president of the Harrisburg area NAACP. Dr. Hairston Allen, welcome to the program. Dr. Allen, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, there we go. Okay. My first day back in the studio for a month and a half. I'm still trying to get caught up here on how everything works. One of the reasons we wanted to have you on the program, Dr. Allen, is that you were at the protest in downtown Harrisburg at the state capitol on Saturday. That started off, well, I'll let you tell the story, but started off a little differently than what it ended. Tell me about your experience on Saturday.
Well, let me see if I can capitalize for just a moment, because it's a very long afternoon. I was only there for about an hour and 15 minutes for the first part. First of all, I want to congratulate our young white, black, and brown young adults for their very opinionated speeches, for their collaboration in understanding what had happened on Monday with Mr. Floyd, and then in their capacity of, I guess, what you call protest, they did very well. Unfortunately, personally, and my personal opinion is that there were some individuals, even there in the beginning, who were not there for the health of the community. And of course, through the afternoon, different levels of activity began to happen. So let me say again, first of all, they were within the barriers. They were on the steps that had been set up, and there were two sets of barriers on the steps. There was a lower barrier and an upper barrier. And of course, the young people and they engaged a few hundred people. They engaged in civility, and it was okay. I was there. I had my mask on, my hat on, and I was keeping my social distance. There were many there that didn't have a mask on, and I would say that they had a disregard for their fellow man or whatever. But it was civil, so I'm going to say that. I rest there. It was civil in the beginning.
Okay, so then what? After you left, but before you left.
No. Before I left.
Okay, go ahead.
There were certain individuals that I visually saw and heard them say, "This is too quiet. Let us move up the steps." And so they began to speak vocally, and the crowd, some of the crowd began, older members in the crowd, adults, began to move toward the barriers. They moved the barriers and threw the barriers to the side. Then that wasn't enough. They moved to the upper level and moved the barriers. And as they threw the barriers to the side in the grass, I thought to myself, this is the beginning of a failure. And so when they got to the top, they marched back down. This took 10 or 15 minutes. When they returned to the lower level of the steps, I heard them begin to say, it's time to take the streets. So without a formal agenda and without formal leadership in the protest, I thought that taking the street was going to cause enough confusion to bring the police department. But they didn't. The police weren't present in that particular time. But as they said they were going to march down the street, that's when I overheard people saying, it's time to rock the police. I looked around and I said, I don't see any police. What? And then that's when I called my wife, and I had decided that when that mass amount of people moved from the Capitol steps down the street toward Front Street, that this was going to be something that was going to be a change from the norm, from the protest. And so that's my mindset on that. The children and the young people were decent. They were noble. They were displaying good citizenship, but there was an overcast of older people, and I believe to myself they were outsiders who initiated that type of negativism within that crowd to bring them to what happened later on in the hours.
When you say outsiders, were these people, and you said adults for the most part, adults meaning over the age of 18, 19, 20, older people.
Yes,
White or black?
Both white and black.
So mm-hmm. when, from what I understand then, you had left, and Chief Thomas Carter, Harrisburg Police Department, Harrisburg Mayor Eric Papenfuss, said that what set off the violence was a woman that threw a flagpole or hit a police car with a flagpole, hit the windshield and broke the windshield. There were four police officers who were then encircled by a crowd, and mm-hmm. other police officers wearing riot gear came down the street. Now, you know, some of the witnesses said everything was fine until the police officers arrived dressed in riot gear. Chief Esserman, let me turn to you now. I've heard this several times over the weekend, that the police officers dressed in riot gear with shields, with the semi-automatic rifles, with the helmets, all those things, that this ratcheted up tensions and made the situation worse, which led to violence. What about that? When do police departments come dressed that way? And what do you say to people that say that, you know, those kind of tactics, that does increase the tensions?
Well, first, I'd like to say how frustrating it is when there are provocateurs in the crowd who distort the message and distract us from the real story of what's going on in America between police and the community. But nevertheless, when it comes to your question in particular about equipment and uniform, it sounds like the police stayed away for a while and allowed people to protest and even to move fences and barriers and didn't react, but were provoked at some point. Is the uniform itself provocative? Well, in the world of policing, one of the responsibilities, unfortunately, that are given to the police, as well as community policing and relationships and crime fighting, is civil disobedience control. We don't give that job to the Army, we give that to the police. And the equipment and the uniform that they're given is frightening. It's used very sparingly. Some departments have different decision-making authority of who can put it on, who can call it out, but it can be intimidating. And therefore, it just has to be used very carefully and very cautiously.
When you say it's used sparingly, though, most of the video that we've seen from around the country over the weekend, it has not looked sparingly. And that does bring up another question as to when police officers are taught to engage with tear gas or pepper spray, that kind of thing.
Well, it's hard. Police officers are trained to work alone for the most part. This is a team work where you're working as a group, as a unit, and you're trained as a unit. But there's still people inside that uniform who have their values that they bring to the incident. You have to be able to control yourself, but you also have to be able to protect yourself. And all that equipment that they wear is to protect themselves when they're being asked to confront hostile crowds. Therefore, it really has to be used sparingly and has to be held in reserve. I've seen many demonstrations around the country over the last week where officers initially wear plank or in uniform, regular uniform, or on bicycle, or had bicycle helmets on, or had their regular hats on, and didn't have the riot equipment, but pulled it out when it was needed. So it can be provocative, and police have to use it judiciously.
But what are the rules of engagement?
In a group situation or in a one-on-one?
Well, in a group situation.
I would say the most important value is discretion and restraint and discipline. You follow the orders of your leaders who are next to you, and you give a lot of leeway, but when necessary, you use force. You use minimal amount of force necessary. So you're not using real bullets. You're using rubber bullets, which are dangerous as they are. No such thing as non-lethal. It's less than lethal, but it's not non-lethal because they can still kill if it hits you in the right place. They use gas, and they make a decision to act and act quickly rather than delay and let tensions rise to the point where it gets out of control, where many people are going to be hurt. The idea is to de-escalate the situation, not to escalate it.
Dr. Allen, I want to bring you back into the conversation. We're going to be talking in just a moment about what the protests achieve. But in your mind, I mean, I have to say that after this weekend, just an observation, that many people will be focused on the protest and the violence, the protest that turned violent, rather than George Floyd, what happened in Minneapolis, and that's what many people will take away. Do you agree with that?
I certainly do. And we need to be advised that in all of the protests across the United States and these groups, you remember that we're in the midst of a pandemic. Not only that, but we have 31 million people unemployed. And trying to synthesize or separate these mindsets in these groups is going to be very hard to do because, different percentages of different groups are driven by different causes. So you have the poor and the poor. You have the looting. You have the mean and the mean come with guns and bricks and other things like that. Then you have those who are peaceful, who are the citizenry of the United States in good conscience, walking hand in hand and trying to get this done. And then you have the young people who are just now coming into what we call society or are being aware now of the Constitution and democracy and other things like that. And when we have this looting and fighting and burning and other things, it distorts their view of what America really is. So I'm listening today to news and programs and other things like that. But one of the things that we must accept and understand is that racism and all of these things that are connected to it that are evil are set in the mind and the heart. It's not in the guns. It's not in the baton. It's not in the tear gas and all the other things. It's a mindset, and that's where we need to go to deal with what we're dealing with now in America.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Well, that's what it sounded like in downtown Harrisburg on Saturday afternoon, and not as much, but yesterday in Harrisburg as well. Joining us now on the program is Dr. Todd Mealy. He's founder of the Equity Institute for Race Conscious Pedagogy, the author of Race Conscious Pedagogy, Disrupting Racism at the Majority White Schools. Dr. Mealy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Scott. It's a pleasure to join you. Thanks for having me.
Also with us today, staying with us, is Chief Dean Esserman, National Police Foundation Senior Counselor, and he is a former police chief in Providence, Rhode Island, and a former district attorney, assistant district attorney in New York City as well. Dr. Mealy, you wrote a column that I have to say it was provocative about the violence, the violent reactions at the protests. Tell me what you're thinking. I don't know whether I'd say you justified the violence, but you say you understand the violence.
I don't advocate looting and violence, but you know, this is the work I've been doing for about 15 years now, and coincidentally, I've been writing about what I call the white liberal problem for a few months. And more directly to your question, I lost sleep Thursday night watching the news, and then woke up to the arrest of the CNN reporter Omar Jimenez, and then the juxtaposition that a white CNN reporter just down the street wasn't arrested. So I grabbed my laptop and started to write. There are people out there, white folks, who feel the way that I feel about these topics about race in America, but they don't have the language to articulate themselves. So I thought putting my thoughts into words would help folks as they engage in these conversations. You know, I wrote this, Scott, because watching the news, I could predict what the discourse was going to be like. You know, what I noticed from the dialogue in 2014 and 2015 was that the attention gets deflected toward the chaos and disruption of the protests. In this case, the attention was going to be redirected away from the terrible murder of George Floyd, and away from the people that are actually peacefully demonstrating, only to cast the spotlight on the looters, assuming that all the looters are black and brown, while ignoring the white looters that are also in the street, and those that are silent about racial injustice would have no problem speaking out against the protests then. And in the end, we wouldn't get anywhere, and there would be nothing to learn from this.
You said that it was predictable in your mind as to what the response was going to be. But, you know, we've heard often over the past few days about the violence not being justified. And we've heard many people, especially white people, who have asked, well, why would you resort to violence? Why are you destroying your own property, the stores in which you shop, and the neighborhoods in which you live? You tried to answer those questions in the column that you wrote.
Yeah, one of the things I addressed was the idea about African Americans and other non-black people of color in the United States are colonized people in the United States. So unlike most colonized countries, where Africans were taken from Africa, brought to the United States, where they were here colonized. First as enslaved persons, then as people subjected to racialized zones without the rights of first-class citizens, then through court order sanctions, the closing of black schools and placed into white schools, into an education system that catered toward white Eurocentric values, white culture and history, and all that black culture, black history was then moved away, eradicated from their education experience. So during all of this, living in communities that are over-policed. So I say this, you know, comparing my experience in America, where I rarely, if ever, saw police officers when I was growing up.
So, okay, you did compare that, but in your column, you say that you understand the reaction to it. Again, you say you don't justify the looting and people getting hurt, but you understand that it has risen to this point because of the built-up anger.
Yeah, I regret the fact that we've had seven nights of craziness on the streets across the country. I wish there was no violence. I wish protesters could distinguish between law enforcement officers that haven't done anything wrong and those police officers that have. But this is due to the fact that a system that exists where black and brown males in particular are disproportionately killed by state violence and incarcerated. So like, we should realize that there are three things behind what's getting attention on the news, the looting, and not the peaceful protests, but the attention-grabbing looting, is that there is a history of violence against black bodies in the country. The economic crisis caused by the pandemic adds to this as well. I think that's part of the story. And then there's the wave of stories about death of African American people in just a short time period within the month of May. So we must distinguish between protesters and looting, between peaceful demonstrators and violent demonstrators. Not everyone showing up at those protests, are there to ask for justice. They're there to exploit the demonstrations. So I don't think we should lose focus on the fact that most of the people that we see in the streets are there to voice, you know, their experiences in the United States that have everything to do with, you know, the history of violence towards black and brown bodies and systemic racism.
You know, Dr. Mealy, you were a football coach at Penn Manor and a teacher. You've written a number of history books, and you have several books, as I mentioned, in the works right now. But, you know, there may be some people, and this is one of the reasons it's so difficult to have a conversation about race in this country. Some people say, well, you're a white man.
Yeah.
What do you know about it? What do you know about this experience of African-American or people of color?
You know, Scott, I get that question a lot. You know, I said I've been doing this work for about 15 years, and I'm okay with that question. I accept it. But this is part of that question is also part of the problem within white America, which is, many folks don't see white as a race, which it is. It's a socially constructed race like the other races that we have. So in other words, race is not some ancillary topic. I see it at the center of everything in our society and in our culture. And much of the problems that we have today is because of the silence that comes from the white community, from white parents, you know, from white educators as well. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I get at with that column you brought up is, you know, this thing I call the white liberal problem, which is white people who proclaim themselves to be sympathetic to the black experience and show disappointment, they show heartbreak when a racism isn't occurs while ignoring the inequities in our own local environs, if you will, our jobs, our schools, disparities in health care and the wealth gap and whatnot. So when I'm asked that question, actually that's the question that should, if you flip that question, I'm sorry, Scott, if you flip the question, what should be asked is why aren't more white people getting involved in this? But that doesn't mean that you need to be out there front and center. It means you can get involved in this struggle while taking the leadership of black and brown Americans, you know, that experience these injustices in our society.
Dr. Todd Mealy is the founder of the Equity Institute for Race-Conscious Pedagogy, the author of the Race-Conscious Pedagogy, Disrupting Racism at the Majority White Schools book. Dr. Mealy, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I want to bring back in Sandra Thompson, who is the president of the NAACP in your county. Ms. Thompson, what do you think about what Dr. Mealy had to say about the reason that sometimes these protests do turn violent? Why do they turn violent, in your opinion?
Well, it's a combination. I also heard Pastor Allen earlier as well, where there's infiltrators that come to these rallies, these protests. The rallies, the protests, they are planned to be peaceful. So typically they become a riot or problematic because of someone. And what we're finding by watching even the social media accounts of some of these other quote-unquote riots is that there's agitators and instigators who are undercover. Now, some people attributed them to being police officers just because of their dress and their mannerism, but we don't know. They were pointed out to be in white males who are intensely smashing property. And unfortunately, then you get into the crowd mentality. Once somebody sees it done, then they follow along. There were some people who would stop it. There were some people who would protect police. But then, as I said, there were some people that put fuel to the fire to turn it to negativity and, yes, to change the narrative to the negative, to stop the positive message from being heard. And also, again, because of even white liberals are always looking for another reason besides race to excuse bad acts. Even white liberals can be turned off of the cause when you say that someone did something wrong or they see something that's being done wrong, although they're favorable, as they say, for the cause. It only takes one negativity for them to say, well, maybe it was justified. And so that's the reason why these instigators and these aggravators come into these protests, to turn away would-be allies.
Yeah, President Trump has suggested that Antifa, the anti-fascist group that has used violent tactics in the past, that they may be behind some of this unrest. What do you think of that?
Well, that's all possible. We don't, you know, many people have an agenda. We really can't say, but I think what we need to do is for the media, for the people watching, is to not always attribute it to black people. Because what we see, again, on social media that I'm constantly dealing with, and even with white liberal, quote-unquote, allies, is the statements of, again, why would you destroy your own neighborhood? What would Martin Luther King Jr. do? You know, why can't you protest in a different way? And then people are pointing out all the numerous protests that was done from Colin Kaepernick and other people protesting, and that still was denied to them. That still was taken as a negative. So it's like no matter what we do, is taken as a negative. The other thing is, when you, T.D. Jakes, I heard him say that the knee to the neck is the same as a noose because it stops you from breathing. And when you look at people who are in the midst of not breathing, in the midst of dying from over-policing, mass incarceration, school-to-prison pipelines, incarceration because of poverty, inequitable education funding. When you look at take all of that in, you have a community feeling like they can't breathe, feeling like that they are dying from suffocation, then you flail. You flail about, and through that flailing, trying to save yourself, you may cause destruction. You lash out.
Let me interrupt.
That is part of what you see.
Because we only have about 90 seconds or so left.
Yes.
I'll ask you the same question that I ask, or you know, a little bit of the same context of Dr. Allen. It would seem as though in the day or so, the few days after the death of George Floyd, that this was a breaking point and that maybe it was an opportunity for the nation to discuss race or address some of those inequities that you talk about, but that what's getting so much attention now is when there is unrest or there is violence at some of these protests. Are you concerned that that's going to take away from what was an opportunity to have this discussion?
Well, it's our job in these positions to make sure that the message doesn't get lost. So we have to keep redirecting people. So again, even when I'm dealing with the community or would-be allies, then I'm redirecting the communication to what are the things that we can do to make a change, such as tomorrow is the time to vote. Everybody needs to get out there to vote because it affects politicians, affect policy, and policy affects how people are treated and who is held accountable. So we have to just keep the narrative into action items that's going to move us forward, despite the detractors.
Real quick, we had a listener ask if there are any, is there any reliable data on increase in violence of African Americans since President Trump's election last 4 years? And I have to ask a quick answer if you know if there is.
Well, I'm sure there is some data. I mean, I think you can see, honestly, there's been students marching in schools. We've seen more Confederate flags and shoutings of white power. So you actually can see it.
I hate to interrupt, but I'm almost out of time. Sondra Thompson, president of the York Area NAACP, Chief Dean Esserman, National Police Foundation Senior Counselor. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
And coming up tomorrow, we're back in the studio this week. We will continue our coronavirus conversation and see what other events transpire.